Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. It means a lot to hear from you. Today, we have with us Melanie Diesel, founder of Story Fuel and author of the book, The Content Fuel Framework, How to Generate Unlimited Story Ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could go back to the very beginning and figure out when I first fell in love with stories. But I think it's sort of been in my DNA, in my personality since the very beginning. You know, my parents said that when I was a baby, I always wanted to be reading books. You know, I was really interested in stories, even as a baby. I think most of us are, right? But I studied journalism. You know, what I loved about journalism was that every story that I was assigned was an invitation to become an expert in something new. You know, I could go and interview experts and study something and check out the research on it and then get to turn around and share that with other people. You know, really kind of, it was like teaching, but also being a student at the same time, you know? And I loved that from a knowledge gathering and sharing standpoint. And so what I found is that there was a lot of need for that kind of skill and that kind of sensibility in the marketing world, you know, that we needed to sort of take a more journalistic approach to the content we were creating in many cases. And I found that, you know, even though I had imagined I would always end up a journalist and work in news, that those same skills were kind of really valuable on the marketing side. And so it was definitely not an intentional journey that I took, but it was one that, you know, sort of I saw the opportunity, I was open to it. And I figured if somebody's going to be creating brand content, it might as well be someone who comes with a journalism background and can lend all those skills and experiences to that process.
Melanie Diesel is a keynote speaker, author, award-winning branded content creator, and lifelong storyteller on a mission to share the power of compelling and credible content with others. Melanie is the author of The Content Fuel Framework, How to Generate Unlimited Story Ideas. She's the chief content officer at Story Fuel, which teaches marketers, publishers, creators, and companies of all sizes how to tell better brand stories. Prior to founding Story Fuel, Melanie was the first editor of branded content at the New York Times, founding member of HuffPost's brand storytelling team, and served as director of creative strategy for Time Incorporated. Melanie studied journalism at the University of Connecticut and earned her MA in Arts Journalism from Syracuse University. She serves on the board of the Native Advertising Institute and is a member of the NYC chapter of the National Speakers Association. She'd love if you'd follow along with her adventures on Twitter and Instagram. Now, listen to this Bits About Books episode full of ideas with Melanie Diesel. Melanie, welcome to Bits About Books. I am so excited to talk to you about a book which is just about getting into the hands of people. And thank you for coming and joining us today.
Thanks for having me and letting me share my story.
I really want to know what triggers your interest in stories about brands. What is it that sort of motivates you?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could go back to the very beginning and figure out when I first fell in love with stories. But I think it's sort of been in my DNA, in my personality since the very beginning. You know, my parents said that when I was a baby, I always wanted to be reading books. You know, I was really interested in stories, even as a baby, I think most of us are, right? But I studied journalism. You know, what I loved about journalism was that every story that I was assigned was an invitation to become an expert in something new. You know, I could go and interview experts and study something and check out the research on it and then get to turn around and share that with other people. You know, really kind of, it was like teaching, but also being a student at the same time, you know? And I loved that from a knowledge gathering and sharing standpoint. And so what I found is that there was a lot of need for that kind of skill and that kind of sensibility in the marketing world, you know, that we needed to sort of take a more journalistic approach to the content we were creating in many cases. And I found that, you know, even though I had imagined I would always end up a journalist and work in news, that those same skills were kind of really valuable on the marketing side. And so it was definitely not an intentional journey that I took, but it was one that, you know, sort of I saw the opportunity, I was open to it. And I figured if somebody's going to be creating brand content, it might as well be someone who comes with a journalism background and can lend all those skills and experiences to that process.
Yeah, and I think with the advent of internet and mainstream papers getting under a lot of pressure, so we call it infomercial or advertorial, whatever way you, I mean, call it brand stories. So that was sort of becoming mainstream. So I think that's also coincided and sort of helped you to make that shift.
Definitely. There was a lot of need for it, you know, and I think when we talk about brands have been telling stories for hundreds of years, you know, that's not necessarily new, but exactly as you said, when we move things online, we used to be in an environment where a brand story was just a brand buying a full page ad and they happened to put some words on it instead of pictures, right?
Yeah.
And when we moved to the internet, things got a lot more detail, a lot more nuance. There was more opportunity for them to create things that were more native to the environment. So yeah, we talk about, you know, infomercials and advertorials. But there's also this sort of secondary category of sponsored content or branded content that is slightly more elevated. It's usually slightly less product focused and more in keeping with what's the natural editorial content in that environment. So that's really where I try to spend more of my time is the stuff that's slightly more elevated and tries to live up to more journalistic standards from a quality perspective.
Wonderful. Because I remember early days when you mentioned this full page ads where they told stories. I remember that David Ogilvy ad for, I think, Mercedes, where he said at 60 miles per hour, the loudest noise comes from the clock. So it was still a narrative, a story that they were trying to, the image they were trying to build, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and even going back, I mean, I think it was John Deere who creates, you know, the riding lawnmowers and other, you know, landscaping equipment. I mean, they've been creating a magazine called The Furrow for over 100 years that is built for farmers and, you know, sharing tips for how they can care for their crops and, you know, optimize their farms. So we've always understood the power of storytelling. I think you almost can't even talk about storytelling unless you make that the obligatory mention of when we were all gathered around fires in the early days of human stories, right?
Absolutely.
So we know that this narrative approach, this really works. This is how we connect. It's how we learn. And so it's just really a matter of figuring out how do you strategically do that as a brand to make sure that you're also furthering your business goals and not just, you know, having a lot of fun.
So when you move from New York Times to Huffington Post to head their brand stories, was there any fundamental change in what you were doing?
Yeah, so I started out at the Huffington Post and there it was much less journalistic, right? When we think of the Huffington Post, we don't necessarily think of hard-hitting reporting. It's usually more entertaining, right? There's more fun, it's listicles. It's probably closer to the BuzzFeed end of the content spectrum, right? So when I was there, I was creating a lot of fun content, you know, things like recipe content for our food section in partnership with Yoplait or Cheerios or Green Giant. I was creating content for our business section, you know, five tips for your small business to survive tax season in partnership with Amex or Goldman Sachs. But I wasn't doing reporting, really. You know, I wasn't interviewing sources. I wasn't, you know, looking for outside sources to back up our stories. It was really just helping the brands translate some of their lighter stories into HuffPost format, really. So when I moved over to the New York Times, obviously that's a very different context, right? That's not, you don't find listicles and things like that, you know, five tips is not necessarily the structure you expect from the Times. So we had to take a very different approach to the brand storytelling we did. And that much more closely mirrored the journalistic background that I had. So things that were multimedia, that were much longer form, you know, thousands of words instead of just hundreds of words. Things that included, like I said, multimedia formats. So there was an article and video and infographic and audio. You know, we were really trying to raise our standards and make sure that we were meeting the expectations of a New York Times reader, which are just different than the expectations of someone reading another publication. So it was definitely a much more in-depth content, much more rigorous from a production standpoint to be able to meet those expectations and create something that our audience would love, that we would be proud of as an organization, and that sort of in most ways met the objectives of the brand.
So was it dictated? I mean, of course, New York Times and its own approach to news and stories and whatever else they do. Right. Was it dictated by the frame of mind, or was it really dictated by the New York Times brand?
So I think it's a little bit of both, right? I think a lot of it has to do with the audience expectations. You know, I give the example that there are certain things you might be willing to buy at the dollar store because you don't need it to last a long time. You don't need it to be, you know, super high quality. You just need it to do the job. There are other things that you go to a more premium retail store for because you want it to be higher quality, you want it to do the job, right? And you might be okay with both of those things. You have some high quality items from the premium store, you have some that are maybe just more doing the minimum job. But if you get one of those minimum job items from the premium store, you're going to be very disappointed. That was not your expectation or your intent. And so it really, a lot of it has to do with the expectation. If I go to HuffPost or BuzzFeed, I'm looking to smile. I'm looking to fill out a quiz. I'm looking for something fun I can share with a friend. If I go to the New York Times, I'm expecting it to be trustworthy, credible, well-reported, in-depth, multimedia. And so I want to make sure that we're meeting those expectations as the person, you know, creating that sponsored content. It wasn't necessarily a requirement from in-house. You know, everything we do must be check, check, check. It was more just trying to say, how do we live up to that expectation so that our audience isn't disappointed when they come upon our content in this New York Times environment?
What happened when you switched from this to your own organization? So what necessitated that?
So I think what I found is that what I loved most about my job, you know, creating content is always wonderful. I still love to create when I can. But what I really loved most was the educational side of it. I loved getting to work with the brands, work with the agencies, and help teach them this is how we tell stories in a journalistic way. This is how we can convey that message to our audience, you know, in a really credible and compelling way. I loved getting to work with my colleagues on the sales team or the ad ops team and say, look, this is how we can present it in the most compelling light. This is how we can, you know, pitch it to our brands and help get them on board to believe in the power of this content we create. And so I realized that that was really where I was most fulfilled, right? That's where I felt like I could really bring the most unique value. There are a lot of really talented creators out there who could step in and create awesome work. But this kind of teaching work is something that I wanted to lean into. So that's why I went out and I started Story Fuel, which is the firm that I'm at now. And we focus on education. So we do, you know, in a non-COVID year, we do a lot of conference workshops, corporate workshops. We do keynotes at conferences, you know, really focused on how can we share this information, this knowledge with as many marketers and creators as possible. You know, obviously in a world where we don't have as many conferences, we're finding other ways to do that. So we also do coaching and masterminds and consulting and things like that. But really what I wanted to do was just give myself the opportunity to do more of that work that fulfilled me most, to be able to share the information with as many people as possible. So hopefully they could come to love storytelling as much as I do.
So that brings me to the book. When did you decide that you have now enough in your mind, which is coherent, and you have a process which you can see there is a repetitive pattern in what you are doing, in so to say. I mean, that's how the framework would have come about, I'm guessing.
Exactly.
When did you decide that, okay, now is the time and I'm ready and I think I have to teach? I mean, I can get the drift that you want to teach. So that sort of fits right in there. When was the trigger?
If I have to be honest, I think it was sort of a two-part process.
Okay.
So I have known I wanted to write a book. Like I said, I studied journalism, so I'm a writer by trade. I've always, you know, we all strive to have that under our belt, right?
Right.
So I've always wanted to write a book. And I think I knew that this framework that I was using in my workshops would be a good fit probably about 2 to 3 years ago. I was teaching it in workshops. People were responding well to it. And there was frequently a follow-up about, okay, now that you've taught us that, do you have more resources? Do you have a guide? Do you have, you know, a book, a workbook? So I knew that there was appetite for it. But I think like most major giant projects, it's really hard to see how that fits into your day-to-day life and how it's achievable. what really was flipped the switch for me is I found out I was expecting our first daughter, you know, my husband and I. And I thought, if I don't get this book written before this baby is born, it will never, ever happen.
Like, I can totally.
It's easier than it will be right now. So I wrote the book while I was pregnant with the deadline of I needed to get it done before my due date was too close so that I could get the manuscript submitted. So that was really what drove me to actually get it done, even though I had the idea about a year prior.
That's a great story in itself, right?
Well, it was a good deadline, that's for sure.
Yeah. And one which you could not manipulate. You couldn't say, okay, I'll push this deadline by 3 weeks.
That's right.
Yeah.
No choice. Get it done.
Great. It's time for a short break. The book has two parts, the kind of stories you can tell and the formats in which you can tell them. I asked Melanie to elaborate on a few. Coming up right after the break. Stay with us.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar. Right before the break, I asked Melanie to elaborate on the way the book is structured around types of stories and different formats in which to tell them. Melanie dove right in. You have broadly two parts to the book. One is, you know, the kind of stories you can tell, and other is the formats that you can use, right? So this is broadly two parts to the book. So let's touch upon a couple of them. You can choose. I mean, you can go with people or history, data, just...
I've got some favorites. Sure. So the book is exactly as you said. It's set up in two major parts. The idea is that every piece of content we create has these two factors. It has the focus, it's about something, and it has the format. It's brought to life in some way. And so one of the big things that you need if you're trying to come up with any content ideas is you just need to decide what's the focus and what's the format. So the book gives you sort of tools you can have in your tool belt. Here's 10 different focuses you should try, 10 different formats you might explore. And that combination gives you 100 different ways to tell any story. So that's sort of the promise of the book. And it's, as you said, a process that can be repeated and used time and again. So when it comes to the focuses, I think there's some that are really familiar and that we tend to like a lot. And those are things like people. People-focused content is some of the most relatable stuff because we can see ourselves in other people's stories. We say, oh, I have that same hobby, or I live in that same neighborhood. I work in that same industry, right? It's very, very relatable stuff. So I love people-focused content. I think that's some of the more interesting stuff out there. But I think that process-focused content is especially important in our current environment that we're living in. So process-focused content is anytime you're trying to help your audience achieve something. So that might be a recipe like we were talking about before. I'm trying to help you make this cake. But it can also be any sort of instructional or DIY-based content. This tends to work really well for search. People are always searching for solutions. But also right now, a lot of us are trapped at home. Our favorite establishments we may not have access to in the same way. And so the idea that you can coach your audience through a process, help them do something, make something, fix something, is going to make you particularly valuable, probably for the near-term future, because I think it'll take quite a bit for things to get back to complete normal across the globe.
Yeah, that's a great idea, because I think you do not think of process as a story idea, right? So normally it's like, the back end, that's something happening there and you really don't talk about it and so on, right? Tell me a bit about curation, because that's something which is very, very much in focus with this huge amount of content out there. But let's hear from you what you think about it.
Yeah, curation is really great, especially if you're just starting out or you're maybe concerned you don't have a lot of time or resources for content. There's a couple approaches. You can curate other people's content, other people's things as recommendations. So that might be, you know, for you, 10 books that everyone should read, right? Or 10 books every entrepreneur should read, you know, podcasts to listen to, workouts to try at home. There's so many different ways you can take with this, but just collecting different items like a museum curator would and presenting them to your audience based on those shared characteristics. It's usually something that you can do fairly quickly if you have a good vision of what it is that you're curating, you understand your criteria, and that makes it really attractive. It's also really helpful for your audience because they don't have to search around and find these things in different places. They can trust that this has been all been brought together and made easier for them. But I think one of the underrated things you can do is curate your own content. So for you, that might mean that you're curating, here's my 10 best episodes of the year, my 10 most listened episodes of the year. You're sort of resurfacing your own best content to make sure other people don't miss it. And so this is a really good way for you to, on a monthly, quarterly, or annual basis, to resurface some of your best stuff that either maybe it didn't get enough attention the first time, or it got a lot of attention and you want to boost that even more. You can collect them by, you know, similar characteristics. Here's the 10 best about this topic, 10 best books for marketers, 10 best episodes for, you know, for entrepreneurs, for homeowners, you know, whatever the case may be. You can collect them based on those characteristics. And so it really does a good service to your audience because you're putting similar resources in one place, and that saves them time and makes you seem like someone who's providing a lot of value.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The other one I would like to talk, actually two of them, I would like to touch upon is data and opinion, right? I interviewed a gentleman called Todd Caponi a few episodes back, and he wrote a book called Transparency Sale, right? And the point was that people are driven by peer reviews. So I don't know whether it connects with your what you are talking about, but that's, it's sort of out there. So how do you think opinion could be a source of story?
Yeah. So the idea with opinion is that you're really seeing how you can put someone's, whether it's yours or someone on your team in your organization, their personal belief, you know, their personal experience into a piece. So if we think about something like, we were just talking about the doing a roundup of your best episodes, for example. Well, one of the ways to do that roundup could be your favorite episodes, the ones you personally enjoyed doing the most or enjoyed listening to the most. Now, that's pretty similar to just curating our 10 most viewed episodes, but that's based on a different criteria. My 10 favorite episodes is based on your personal opinion. So they're kind of like sister topics in many cases. But it also might be you creating a piece of why I started this podcast or what I learned from doing this many episodes, or, you know, just kind of putting your personal belief into it in some way, your personal perspective. As we talked about with people-focused content, it does make it more relatable. People, you know, especially if you're the face of your own brand or the voice of your brand, people want to connect with you. They want to know what you think. And I think in many cases, even if it's not an individual, the organization who's creating the content is an expert. And so we trust the opinion of the organization, the recommendation of the organization. You know, you think about many of your listeners, maybe they're considering writing a book or they're considering starting a podcast. They're going to look to authors and podcasters for recommendations about equipment I should buy or who I should work with or the order of operations, right? So they trust that opinion of individuals and experts. So putting your opinion out there can be really valuable because people, again, they connect to it and they do trust expert opinions.
Great. And how does data fit into this?
Data is fun. The reason I put data in there is, you know, many times we include bits of data in our other stories. We may quote a statistic or something, but sometimes it's really valuable to consider, can I approach this story purely through the numbers? Can I look at trends, at statistics, at research, at studies? Can I sort of unpack the process and look at the data behind that story? This can sometimes just cause you to take a slightly different route that can give you a new approach to a story. So one example I like to give is many times a conference, for example, since I speak at a lot of conferences, they'll do an event recap and they'll say, we had, you know, these speakers and they talked about these wonderful topics and we had a wonderful time and here's some photos from the networking party, the end. But wouldn't it be interesting to see the numbers behind that conference? How many people attended? How many nations were represented by the attendees? How many cups of coffee were drank? How many, you know, light bulbs needed to be changed? How many chairs were set out for the event, right? Just looking at the numbers. It may not be the whole of the story, but it can give you a different approach. And sometimes looking at that, how many tickets sold, how many connections were made, is a different way to tell that same type of story. And so that's just having it in the checklist, you know, of different focuses is just a reminder that sometimes approaching things from the numbers is an interesting way to approach it in a new way.
Yeah, I totally agree. And as you were telling me, I was remembering Hans Rosling and his presentation at TED, if you remember, about the growth of population and all of that. It's sort of like data visualization, what you said. So he was just presenting things that you already knew, but in a different format. And that made it so arresting in terms of getting attention. Great. So moving on to formats, there is no formula, right? Or is there one?
Well, I think what I find is that a lot of it is gut. A lot of it is your gut. You sort of tend to know what the right format is if you focus on the focus first. If you know the story you're trying to tell, you just said it naturally, right? He was telling the data about the population and it was so much more compelling because it was visual. So you know, oftentimes, if you're clear on what you're trying to say, it becomes easier to know how best to say it. Our problem is that we often start the opposite. We say, I need a video idea or I need an article idea. And so we force something that doesn't fit and it's not a match. But if we start with the story first, you can say, well, is this a visual story? Do I need visuals with it? Yes. Okay. Well, then it probably should be a video, an infographic, or a photo, right? Because those are my visual options. Does it have great sound quality? Well, then maybe we want to do a video or, you know, use audio. So I think if you're really clear on what it is that you're trying to say, it becomes much easier to figure out how to say it. And so again, that's the whole idea with the second part of the book is to say, here are 10 different formats to consider. And as long as you know you're focused first, you should be able to choose pretty easily from among them. And I think one of the things that I tried really hard to do was to make the formats platform agnostic. So sometimes people will say, well, what about a tweet? Or what about Instagram? Or what about YouTube? You know, well, Instagram is a photo, so that falls into the images category, you know, or YouTube is a video, so that falls into the video category. We're not trying to break it down to every possible place that your content can live, just to its most basic parts. How is it made?
That's an interesting point that you raise, because you may be familiar with this very famous slide deck that Gary Vee shared, where he said that one piece of content can be made repurposed into 160 pieces and so on and so forth.
Yes.
So it's really what he's talking about really is the delivery, and what you're talking about is really the creation process. I mean, if you have a video, it can go into every single channel that takes video, right?
Of course. Exactly. Yeah. And so that's what the question becomes. You know, you can strategically distribute it anywhere. If you write a sentence, you could paste that sentence in 1,000 places. But the question is, should it have been a sentence in the first place, or should it have been a photo or a video or an infographic or an audio interview? You know, what form should it have taken? And then by all means, there are so many different ways to promote your content. You know, take advantage of as many as make sense for your audience and for your topic. But you really need to spend time figuring out how to bring that story to life in a way that's going to work for your audience.
When you are talking to a new organization, so they do not really have a depth of history. They don't have a lot of the things that you have there as pointers. They don't really have great charismatic leader or the face. And this is a really new story that they're trying to tell.
Sure.
What should be their go-to framework?
So one of the things that I always encourage people to do if they're new to this, and again, especially if you have limited resources, I think the easiest place to start is whatever your version of a testimonial is, try to tell that in a slightly more narrative way. So if currently you have students or clients or vendors or customers who are giving you just a little sentence and their name and that's it, ask how you can make that, how can you expand that just a bit? Ask them a few more questions. Ask them to submit a headshot along with it. You know, build that up to the point where maybe you interview them and ask all kinds of really fun questions about why they made this choice. Why did they choose you? What did they almost do instead? What was at stake for them? You know, really dig into it. That's often the easiest place to make your transition into more compelling storytelling, because We all know the value of customer stories in some form. We all have some version of testimonials or success stories or case studies. So that's often an easy place to get buy-in from your organization, from your leadership to say, I'm going to try to make those just a little bit better, make them work just a little bit more for us. And then as you do that, it can start to give you a little bit more runway to take the same approach with other areas of your content.
Well, that's a wonderful, wonderful suggestion. I think people are lazy. What you just said needs effort. And people sort of, they want to check the box that, yes, I have testimonials done, but they really don't want to put in the effort, right? So that sort of makes the difference when I'm talking to people. I see that very distinct difference between guys who are successful and the teams which are not so successful. Yeah. That's the core difference, that they're not really digging into the stuff that they already have and they're chasing something else, right?
And that's often the secret. That's really a big part of the mission with the book is so many people feel like content marketing is this big, giant, scary thing that requires skills I don't have and experience I don't have. I'm not a creative. This is not my thing. It does require work, right? Doing anything well takes time and takes effort. But it doesn't have to be so giant and scary. There are small ways, little changes. And it's really more about doing more with what you have, right? You already have content. You already have smart people and great products. And you already have all these elements. It's just a matter of figuring out how do we message that in a more compelling way. So we're not talking about a total remake of everything. You don't have to rebrand. You don't have to change your entire process and mission and purpose. We're just talking about small ways that you could tell that story a little bit better, create deeper connections with your audience, and hopefully create more conversion in the process.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
That was wonderful, Melanie. I really appreciate your taking the time talking to us. That was a great chat. I really enjoyed it. So tell our listeners where they can find the book and where they can find you.
Yeah, so the book is called The Content Fuel Framework, How to Generate Unlimited Story Ideas. It's available on Amazon, which is often the easiest thing for folks spread throughout the world. It's also on Barnes & Noble and a couple other ebook sites as well. If you head to storyfuel.co, so that's storyfuel.co, that's our website. You could learn more about the book and other options if you need them. Learn more about our consulting. There's a contact page, so you can find me on your favorite social media of choice. So storyfuel.co is your one-stop shop if you want to reach out, learn more, or find ways to work with us.
Wonderful. We'll get this added to the show notes. Thank you very much, Melanie. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thanks for letting me share my story.
Coming up in the next episode is a mind-opening conversation with Fred Kopstick on his book, Selling Through Partnering Skills.
I can see that sales is taking very much a move towards being more collaborative than ever. You know, we can go through all the evolution of sales and the stuff that we saw in the 60s, psychological selling, if you like, and 80s, close, 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 and of course the consultative stuff of the 90s. But now people are having to be more collaborative. I would say that even more so now, salespeople are going to have to work tightly with customers, help them, guide them, be in the thing together. But I came across this concept of partnering skills, PQ. Now, everyone will probably have heard of IQ, and I'm sure many people will have heard of EQ, emotional intelligence. And I think of PQ, or partnering intelligence, as almost like the lesser-known cousin in the family. And these are the skills that somebody who's good at partnering will have and are able to use.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.